Now, one of the interesting things about Christianity, and something that I think ought to convince us that it's come from God and is not something that we human beings have dreamed up by ourselves, is the way that so much of its teaching is the opposite to what we would normally think. This is so much so that I suggest if anybody asks you a question, what the Christian view is on something, the best thing you should do is don't answer them immediately. You need to stop, think, give it your best thought, and then say the exact opposite, and 9 times out of 10 you'll be right. Christianity never turns out the way we think it will. For example, who'd have ever thought that the last would be first and the first would be last? Who'd have ever guessed that the greatest people of all in God's eyes are those who give themselves in humble service of others? It's not so much presidents, prime ministers or popes that rate highly in God's eyes, but street sweepers, slaves and the servers of the tea and coffee at All Souls are the ones that he exalts as great. Now, most of us, I think, know this in our heads, but in our human pride, we find it very hard to live out. Why? For it's the exact opposite to what we think and do naturally. And that's the very point. For when we think naturally, we never really think it God's way. And that's why we need to hear what God is saying in his word. And this particular Bible passage is a very case in point. It tells us the opposite of what we normally think. And since we're talking about doing things in an opposite way, I'm going to start at the end first and then go to the first part at the end, the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. So look down at your passage, Luke 18, verses 9 to 14. We'll do the second part first and the first part second. Well, what do we have in this parable? We have two men at prayer. They come to church to pray, they pray, and then they leave. One of them goes home right with God, and one of them leaves an enemy of God, and only God can tell the difference. If you or I had been there on that day, we would have got it wrong unless Jesus had told us in this parable. Well, let's look more closely at these two men. It's not that complicated. There's a good man and there's a self-confessed bad man. The good man is good. We can be sure of that. Pharisees were very good people. They were fastidious people in keeping the rules of God. Now, so often we think of them as charlatans, but let me assure you they weren't that. They read their Bibles regularly, they were deeply concerned that they got it right, and they tried to put into practice all that they'd read. Their Bible scholars had determined that the Old Testament contained 613 commandments, and the Pharisees were determined to keep every one of those commandments in order to please God. They weren't greedy. That's what this man says here. He says, "Thank you, God, that I'm not greedy. I'm not dishonest. I'm not immoral." This man in the parable was religion spelt with a capital R. He's the sort of person who, if he was in as a member of All Souls, he'd be in church every Sunday morning and every Sunday evening and involved in all the groups during the week. And since many of us tonight are in that category, listen very carefully. Now note his prayer, verses 11 and 12. The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself, "God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get." It's a strange sort of prayer, isn't it? For although he begins by talking to God, he actually spends the whole time talking about himself. God only gets a sideways glance. Now let me take a diversion for a minute and ask us all this question. Do we in our prayers do that? Do we only talk about ourselves and our needs in God's presence, or do we have a broader agenda? I like this prayer that one young child was heard to say as she knelt down by her bed. Dear God, please bless Mummy and Daddy and my little brother Alex. And please, God, do bless yourself, because if anything ever happens to you, we're sunk. Or the rather calculating prayer of another child who was heard to yell, please, God, bring me a great big box of chocolates for my birthday. And when his mother told him not to shout, for the Almighty was not deaf, he replied, no, but Grandpa's deaf and he's sitting in the next room. Now, as adults, our prayers may be much more sophisticated than that, but sadly, they're often no less self-centred. They revolve around ourselves and our desires for God, what we want him to do for us, rather than revolving around God and his desires or purposes for us, what he wants to do, what he wants us to do for him. I used this quote a few weeks ago in the morning, a John White quote from his book People in Prayer, but I think it's very apt at this point. John White says this, whatever else prayer is, it is intended to be a sharing and a taking counsel with God on matters of importance to him. Prayer is not intended primarily to be centred on my petty needs and woes. To be sure God's interested in them, they do have a place on his agenda, but the agenda has been drawn up in heaven and deals with matters of greatest consequence. God calls us to attend his celestial board meeting and to deliberate with him on matters of destiny through our prayers. Well, let's divert back and go back to this man. So here he is, he walks into church one day, he comes down the front, he kneels down and he says, oh God, goodbye. That's all God seems to get. He's actually not very interested in God or other people. He just wants God to hear how good he is. I fast twice a week, he says. He only actually had to do it once. I give tithes of everything I get. And he wasn't even obligated to do that. His problem is not basically that he's good, but that he's placed his trust in his goodness. That's his problem, and that can so easily become our problem too. Now the Bible teaches that there are three main things, at least three things, that insulate people from God. Personal goodness, money, and religion. These are the things that people tend to put their trust in. If you've got one of those things, you're in trouble. If you've got two, you're in deeper trouble. And if you've got all three, you'd really better watch out. Well, what's the problem with personal goodness? It's simply this. If you're a really good person, it's very difficult to believe that Jesus needed to die for you. The death of Jesus won't make sense to you. Why? Because you can't think of anything that you've done that's bad enough to have caused Jesus to die for you. It might be okay in theory, in our heads we say it, Jesus died for me, but as a deep reality in our lives that we base our lives upon day by day, it just doesn't become important. Now let me tell you about my dad. My dad is a terrifically good man. As a bank manager, he spent much of his life trying to help those whom we call in Australia the underdogs. That is, people whose luck seems to have run out. If you've got a struggling business, Dad's the man who'll help you out. If you get into trouble and are stuck with your loan repayments, Dad is the man who'll go to pull a few strings in a bank to make sure you're not disadvantaged. Everyone in the western region of Sydney seems to know my dad. For his retirement dinner, the local people put on a huge dinner for him, and they all wore a badge with his initials on it saying, "I'm a DET fan." That's his initials. Even in retirement, Dad continues to do so much, and all that he does very well indeed. But friends, when it comes to the things of God, Dad seems to have a mental blank. He shrugs his shoulders as if to say, "Richard, I'll be okay. I'll sort it all out myself." It's as though he thinks of God as a heavenly bank manager who tots up all the good things we do on one side and all the bad things we do on the other, and where we go depends upon whether we're in the black or in the red at the end. And sadly, he seems to think that because of all the good he's done, he will definitely be in credit. But, and I hate to say this because it pains me so much to say it, that is a slap in the face to God. It's in effect saying to God, "God, I don't need your son to have died for me. I'll sort it all out by myself." It's as Rico explained last week, it's the very core of our human problem. We push God off the centre stage of our lives where he rightly belongs, and we proclaim ourselves the producer, the director, and the main actor of all that we do in our lives. And sadly, as we know, God does not think too highly of those who seek to depose him from his rightful place. That's the problem with personal goodness, and so many people are caught up with it. It's easy for Christians to be caught up with that as well, especially Christians. We work so hard to accumulate what someone has called superfluous piety, and we think that somehow all of this will compensate for any real sins that we've actually committed. So as Christians, we don't smoke, we don't drink, we don't swear too much. We work hard at serving God, and as we do these things, we discover that soon we find we're comparing ourselves with others and thinking we're really not doing too badly, thank you very much. We're a bit like the Sunday school teacher who, in telling this very story to his class, drew what he thought to be the obvious moral lesson. "Now, children," he said, "let's all thank God that we're not like that proud Pharisee." You're slow tonight. It's easy, isn't it, to move into the Pharisee's shoes without even realising it. Someone has said the danger of pride is that a halo has only a few inches to slip and it soon becomes a noose. The Bible warns us that personal goodness can insulate us from God. And the other two things can do it as well. Money can insulate us from God. Why? It gives us a false sense of security. We don't need to trust God for our needs when we've got lots of money to do things with. We think we've got everything we need. And reality, of course, is we don't. Religion does the same. It insulates us from God because a religious person finds it impossible to believe that it's possible to be religious and not be right with God. God, after all, is into religion by definition. So these three things at least that can insulate us from God. And this Pharisee had two out of the three. We're not told if he was rich, but he certainly had personal goodness, and he certainly was religious. Again, what was his problem? It was this.
He'd placed his trust in the wrong things. His trust was placed upon himself and his goodness rather than in God and God's goodness. And let me ask us all this question. Let me ask you, where is your trust placed? This is the question that the Bible challenges us upon day after day after day. Basically, the issue is, where do we place our trust as people? Where do we place our trust? The issue is not do we have faith, but where do we focus our faith? Now recently I bought a new camera with an automatic zoom, and it's a great thing. You look through the lens, the camera, and suddenly the countryside comes automatically closer to you. One touch of the button and it all clicks into focus. It's great fun. And if anyone has shares in Kodak processing, you'll be doing very well out of us at the moment. Now with Christianity, when you turn on the zoom, it's Jesus who gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And when you click, it's his death on the cross for our forgiveness that leaps into focus. And that is where we're to focus our trust. We can focus our trust upon ourselves, or we can focus our trust in the death of Jesus for our sins. God has done everything for our forgiveness. There's nothing else we need to do to get right with God. The question is, where will we focus our trust? Well, let's quickly look at the other man. How does this other man pray? Look at verse 13. The tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Now friends, this is the guy that we're meant to identify with in this story. And it's a scandal that we are meant to identify with him. For unlike the Pharisees, the tax collector was one of the most hated people of his time. No one in their right mind would want to associate with such a man, let alone identify with him. They were to the Jews of their time as a hardened criminal or a drug dealer would be to us today. We make jokes about tax collectors today, but tax collectors then were a despised, hated people and even lynched because of their collaboration with the Roman occupiers. But Jesus says, this is the man we're meant to identify with. He was the one whose prayers were heard by God. What does this man do? He doesn't look up to heaven in all boldness. He feels ashamed. He looks to the ground, knowing all that he's done, and he says, have mercy on me, a sinner. Now it seems to me this is where we now connect with our first parable, the one I haven't spoken of so far. For in the first parable, we also have somebody crying out for mercy. We read in the first parable of a widow who cries out to an unjust judge and says, will you have mercy on me? And the man refuses to do so. No one will give this woman justice, but so intense are her petitions to the judge that finally he relents and says, even though I don't fear God or care about men, yet because this widow keeps on bothering me, I'll see that she gets justice, so she won't wear me out with her coming. Now friend, that parable is not a parable of comparison. It's not telling us God is like that judge, and God will only answer our prayers if we badger him for long enough. That's not what it's saying. It's not a parable of comparison, but a parable of contrasts. This is what it's saying. If such a selfish judge will hear the pleas of that poor woman, in spite of the fact that she's got nothing to offer him, she can't give him any bribes, she's got no money, she's got nothing that he wants. If such an unjust person will respond to her cries, how much more will our loving and gracious God hear us and respond to us when we are like that tax collector and we cry out to him for mercy? Our God will do that. Will God keep putting off his people, says Jesus in verse 7, and the answer is no. That's not the nature of the God we have. He's a God who delights to hear his people. He's able to do that for us that we want him to do, and he wants to do it. He delights in doing it. He wants to forgive us as we come to him pleading for mercy. Our God is a God of great mercy in spite of the fact that you and I have nothing to offer him at all. We can't bribe God with good deeds, our money, our religious activity. None of those things will work with God. Not even having the right orthodox theology or going to the right church can persuade God to accept us. All we simply can do is to cry out to him for mercy. And the parable tells us he will hear us when we do it. That's what the tax collector did. And listen to what Jesus says of him. It is so outstandingly startling. It's opposite to what any of us would have imagined. He says, I tell you that this man, in spite of all his hopelessness and wickedness, that man who humbled himself before God went home justified, right with God, clean before God, forgiven. And he adds, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Two men at church and both at prayer. One goes home mistakenly confident, and the other one goes home with God's approval resting on him. The question for us tonight is, how will we go home from church tonight? Will we go home like that Pharisee, far away from God, too proud to recognise our own need for God, our own need for forgiveness? And if we do, Jesus says, friends, in exalting yourself, one day you'll be humbled by me. Or will we go home like that humble tax collector, forgiven people, justified people, people who are in a right relationship with a loving God, people who stand at the foot of the cross in all our brokenness and weakness and hopelessness and sinfulness, all those things that we know stand between us and God, and claim for the first time for some of us, or again and again for most of us, the forgiveness that God offers us freely because of his Son. God offers us tonight, friends, another chance to refocus our trust upon Christ. Let's just take a moment of quietness and in our hearts seek to do that before him now. God, have mercy on me, a sinner, the sinner. Jesus says, I tell you that it's that man, that woman, that child of God, that person standing here tonight, rather than the other one, who who will go home justified. For whoever exalts themselves will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself before God will be exalted. Just a moment of quietness as you seek to apply that to yourself in your own heart.